Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we start today in East Boston, where a controversial electrical substation is under construction. Now, we have followed the tensions this substation has raised in East Boston since its proposal, and today WBUR climate and environment reporter Miriam Wasser joins us with the latest. Welcome back, Miriam.
Hey, good to be here.
So there is a latest. I want to start there. You have a story out on this week because there's sort of a new controversy you're paying attention to. Tell us about that.
Sure. So the story that we published this week was about a community benefits agreement, right? So this was a controversial project. And when the state approved it in 2021, they sort of acknowledged a lot of the concerns that the community had and said, you know what, Eversource, you need to do something extra to give back to the community. You need to negotiate in good faith a community benefits agreement to either mitigate the impacts of the substation or compensate the community for the added burden. So that happened. The company worked with a couple community groups and came up with a $1.4 million benefits package. It included things like rehabbing a local park, some improvements for a playground, some energy efficiency work for a local Boys and Girls Club. And the story that I wrote this week looks at how the company may actually charge ratepayers for the cost of that $1.4 million.
Rather than paying it out of some other Eversource pot.
Exactly, which means that for some people in the community who have been fighting this project for 8 years, they may actually have to help pay for their own mitigation.
For the mitigation that the agreement. Okay, so there's our framing, right? And we're going to dig into all of this. But now I want to backstep for people who are like, excuse me, what is a substation?
Right? That's a great question.
I don't understand the words that are coming out of your mouth here. So let's start generically speaking. What does a substation do? And when one is built in general, why does one build one?
Yes. So electrical substations serve a very basic purpose. They change the voltage of electricity. There are some substations that step it up to a higher voltage and other that step it down.
So like raw electricity needs to have a certain voltage assigned to it?
Kind of, yeah. So let's say like, we have a power plant. It produces power at a certain voltage.
Okay.
A substation changes that to a different voltage so it can go through the transmission lines.
Got it.
And then after the transmission lines, it goes through another substation so it can go to the telephone wire poles you see around the distribution lines. So the substation in East Boston will take high voltage electricity from a transmission line, turn it to a lower voltage, and then send it into the power lines on the street so it can be used in people's homes and businesses.
Okay, so to use a Goldilocks reference, if the electricity is either too hot or too cold, the substation makes it just right.
Exactly.
To go through some lines so that it can get to Goldilocks, basically.
Absolutely. And substations are everywhere, and they are a very important piece of infrastructure. You probably see them all the time. Sometimes they're of different sizes, but they're like that weird kind of metal-y infrastructure you often see on the side of the highway with like weird coils and space-age looking things.
Okay.
That's an electrical substation.
Okay. So now let's just for a minute touch on how we got to a point where it was necessary to create a community benefits agreement in order for this one to get built in East Boston because residents didn't want it.
Correct. Okay. And residents didn't want it for what I would say are like two major categories of reasons. So the first had to do with public safety, let's say. So the area where this is under construction right now is right on Condor Street in East Boston, right by Chelsea Creek. And it is an area that is relatively low-lying, and the street around there floods already during bad rainstorms. Looking forward at some projections about sea level rise, a lot of people in the community had concerns that this thing was going to flood. And they're saying, why are you building this important piece of electrical infrastructure in a flood zone? During Hurricane Sandy, you might remember seeing that video or that image of like the sky turning bright green all of a sudden. That was a substation that flooded and exploded. Again, substations are like relatively safe unless something goes wrong.
Unless something catastrophic happens.
Right. So people would say, just don't build it here. It's also really close to all the jet fuel for Logan Airport. It's right across the street from a really popular playground. From the point of view of people in the community, the thing I heard again and again was like, we don't want this here. Like, this is a bad spot.
Okay, so that raises something important that I wanted to ask you about. So we're going to have a community advocate voice on in a little bit, but mm-hmm. we also reached out to Eversource for comment and to join us on the show. They couldn't join us live today. They did send an extensive email. And one of the arguments they made right at the top was, listen, East Boston electrical customers need this. They will suffer power outages if they don't have this substation. I think what I'm hearing from you is not necessarily an argument against that, right? That that's not actually necessarily the issue, but maybe the location. Just respond.
Yep,
yeah.
Yep. I think that summarizes it well. We know that probably the biggest electrical customer in East Boston is Logan Airport. And so a lot of people throughout this entire 8-year proceeding have said, put it on Logan Airport. We know it's protected from sea level rise there. They're the major customer, you know. Put it there. Don't take away a plot of land that, from the perspective of many in the community, they thought it was going to be turned into a park or a soccer field. And as we know, East Boston lacks a lot of green space. So yeah. It's often, yes, an argument about location.
Okay.
And then briefly, I will say the other reason that I think people feel so strongly about this project has to do with the process by which it was approved and that it raised a lot of environmental justice issues. Early on, when the company first proposed the project, many people in the community didn't know about it. And then when they did learn about it and tried to participate in public meetings, you know, there was inadequate translation or these meetings were really inconvenient times. And so people have just felt throughout this entire process that their voices never mattered and that no one paid attention to them. So that is part of the issue here as well.
And that's what gets us to this $1.4 million community benefits agreement is to offset some of those concerns. What in your reporting leads you to believe that ratepayers may foot the bill on that?
Sure. So the guest that we'll have on soon from Green Roots, he, along with the Conservation Law Foundation, the two of them are working together and opposing this. They asked Eversource point blank during a different state proceeding who is paying for this community benefits agreement. And Eversource submitted a written statement that said Eversource ratepayers. So that is the genesis of this story, is a piece of paper where they said ratepayers will be paying for this.
Okay, so you set that up perfectly. So I'm going to ask you to sit tight for a minute now, and I'm going to bring in a different voice, which is John Waukee, an East Boston resident director of Waterfront and Climate Justice Initiatives at Green Roots. He has been a strong advocate against the substation and its location. John, welcome to the show.
Hi, welcome, and happy Valentine's Day.
Hey, I almost forgot. Happy Valentine's Day to you, too. There you go. So listen, first, let me just, you have been an opponent, and do you remain an opponent, either personally or professionally, in your Green Roots role of this substation?
Well, I started fighting this as an East Boston resident, and in that time, I ended up getting hired at Green Roots. So I've been opposed to this professionally and personally, and as a resident for now going on 9 years.
And you, as I understand it, John, were a person who received the document from Eversource that said Eversource ratepayers are our target for paying, you know, funding the $1.4 million community agreement, correct?
Yeah, we asked that question in the proceedings at the Energy Facility Siting Board, and it just sort of blew our minds that defies the description of what mitigation is. Mitigation is supposed to be something that you do to lessen the impacts of your project on me, not something that I pay for. I mean, it becomes basically a no-bid contract for them to plant some trees around the neighborhood.
All right, so let's pick up on a couple of those threads or roots, you know, if we want to make the pun. First, I'm going to actually read you a part of the email verbatim that we received from Eversource. So in part, it says, the topic of cost recovery is currently hypothetical because any determination on cost recovery associated with the community benefits agreement would be made once the project is in service and benefiting customers. Even then, we could only request cost recovery in accordance with state and federal regulations, and the appropriate regulatory body would ultimately be the decision maker several years down the road. So if I read this as I understand it, it's too early to be worried about this, and there are protections in place. Somebody else will make this decision. Respond.
Well, it's the people who are making the decision are, you know, the Department of Public Utilities, which staffs the Energy Facility Siting Board. So the people who are basically greasing the skids for a lot of Eversource and other private utility companies' projects are the ones that are going to oversee this and then approve it. And
so you're saying that the deciders are interested parties?
Yeah. I mean, I think that there's a problem in the system that we have set up that has evolved over years of investing in our electrical infrastructure. It's arcane and Byzantine, and it'll make your eyes cross, and it's a good thing, a good sedative. But the reality is when you look under the hood and look at the details of this, it really is not serving the public good. It is really serving the financial interests of some utility companies.
Okay, so I'm going to come back to Miriam for a second because you want to weigh in on that quote from Eversource that we received in an email. Go ahead.
Yeah, because I think it's a little jargony. So what they are saying is it's too early to decide, right, who's going to pay for this community benefits agreement. That's part one of their argument. But that's kind of in direct contradiction to what they said to Green Roots, right? And then the other part is saying, and I did talk to experts who said, you know, no, that's not how utilities work. They know exactly how they're going to account for everything before they spend money. And then to kind of explain that second part with the DPU, what's going to happen is
that's the Department of Public Utilities.
Sorry. Every couple of years, utilities go before the Department of Public Utilities for something called a rate case.
Okay.
And at its most basic, it is when they're asking for cost recovery. So utilities, broadly speaking, can spend money in different ways. There's money that they spend that just gets directly passed on to ratepayers, meaning you pay for it. There's stuff that they do that they pass on to ratepayers and they can make a profit from. They get a guaranteed rate of return. And then there's stuff that they spend that just comes from the company. And so the question becomes, where should the community benefits agreement fall? In which category?
Okay.
And what the company is saying is that decision won't come until many years from now, whereas other experts are saying that's probably not very accurate.
Okay. And just to remind listeners, we did reach out to Eversource. They sent us a written statement. This morning we invited them to appear on the show. They were not able to make that work in time for 11 o'clock today. So, John, I will come back to you, John Walkey, who is the Director of Waterfront and Climate Justice Initiatives at Green Roots. So two questions for you then. So first, I mean, somebody's going to pay for it, right? And in general, don't we have an expectation that a private business covers its costs and pricing?
You would think so. That's how we sort of learn how this stuff sort of works. But the way it actually works now as it has evolved is Eversource has a piece of land. Same thing as if I had a piece of land and I decided to open up a hot dog stand. And I ask you, the hot dog consuming public, to give me the $103 million I need to build my hot dog stand on this property. And you pay me the $103 million and you give me a rate of return because I want a profit on the building I just built. Now that you paid for this building, I own it. If I sell the hot dog stand, I don't give the money back to you because you've invested in it. No, I pocket it and walk away with it.
And excuse me for interrupting for a second, but Miriam, so there were subsidies on the building of this substation.
Not subsidies, but when utilities build things, they get a rate of return or profit. So Eversource will make a profit by building the substation. The question is whether the benefits agreement should be part of the overall cost of the project.
Got it.
They make money off that too.
Okay, so let me backtrack then.
Sure.
One more question to you, John. So if we were in a situation where the dollar amount for the community benefits agreement were X. In this case, it's $1.4 million. Maybe you like that number, maybe you don't. But the dollar amount is X. And there's a guarantee that ratepayers will not essentially foot the bill for that $1.4 million in things. And, Miriam, I pulled this from your reporting. You gave us a headline earlier, too, on this $400,000 for trees, $175,000 for improvement to a park. Would you be okay with where we are on this community benefits agreement?
For myself, no, because I don't want to see the thing built in the first place. It's the wrong place. If I'm paying for it, we all are paying for it. We're ratepayers. We're paying for this investment, and I think that this is the wrong location because in the future, in its lifetime, it's going to be getting flooded and damaged, and we'll be paying again to replace it, which is just crazy. If the mitigation agreement ends up being something that comes out of Eversource's pocket, you know, that's better. But we're going to have to watch that when this thing comes before the Department of Public Utilities in one of these rate cases. We'll have to be watching that for the next couple of years to make sure, because if left to their own devices, they will stick this to the ratepayer, without a doubt.
All right, so I'm going to say goodbye to you there. John Waukee is both an East Boston resident, as we learned today, opposed to this before he started working as the director of Waterfront and Climate Justice Initiatives at Green Roots. Thank you so much for being with
us. Thank you.
So, Miriam, turning back to you, this has been super helpful. Like, I prepped and I still learned a ton while we're talking about this. So, two things then briefly. First, what are you going to watch now? Like, with your reporter's hat on, as somebody who deeply understands this, what are you like?
Oh, great question. I think two things. One would be to see if the company decides that they will pay for the benefits agreement themselves instead of leaving it up in the air what might happen. But then, more broadly speaking, I'm also very interested in this idea of reforming the process by which we approve projects like this. So there is some legislation out there that is looking at, John referenced the Energy Facility Siting Board earlier. This is the state body that approves and reviews large energy projects. It's not very, friendly to the average person. It's hard to get involved. It doesn't a lot of people will contend that it doesn't really take community voices in as much as it should. So there are efforts underway to reform that, because as we move forward, we are going to need to build a lot of electrical infrastructure, and we want to make sure that we're doing that in equitable ways.
Okay, so in my last 30 seconds, that's the other question. It's both a point that Eversource made in their email and one that is on my mind. One way or another, as we electrify vehicles and mm-hmm. we move to electric heat pumps, et cetera, we do need capacity, yes?
Correct.
Okay. And so you're saying, whether it's this controversial substation or another, we've got a process we need to reform, because we will need to build these things that make the porridge just right.
Correct. And okay. And if we have time, I would just pull out one other little thread.
Yes.
One of the people that I talked to, David Pomerantz of the Energy Policy Institute, he's concerned about precedent, right? If we set up a scenario where a utility says, oh, we have this project that nobody wants, let's just throw a bunch of dollars at it, but then have the ratepayers pay for that. I mean, that just sets up a really perverse incentive structure there, and you don't want that moving forward.
Yeah, that is fascinating. Okay, that boom right there is like that last piece of lesson looking for. Miriam Wasser, climate and environment reporter, brought the story to us this week. This was so helpful. Thank you.
Oh, I'm glad. Anytime.
I'm Tiziana Deering, and more on toxic forever chemicals today. Yesterday, we talked with WBUR reporters Gabriella Emanuel and Barbara Moran about these chemicals. They're known as PFAS. Scientists believe PFAS contributes to all kinds of health issues, from cancer to liver damage. Barbara tells us, though, that we keep making more because PFAS are also pretty useful.
They have all these really good chemical properties where they make things waterproof and stainproof and oilproof. So they're using all kinds of things like food wrapping, waterproof raincoats. They're widely used in firefighting foam.
Now, manufacturers have been making PFAS for decades, and they're not going anywhere because they are these things forever chemicals. They almost never break down. And one of the myriad problems they present: contaminating drinking water supplies across Massachusetts. Removing these chemicals isn't cheap, and as Barbara Moran reports today, that means the cost of clean drinking water may soon get a lot higher.
The brand new water treatment plant in Littleton is not a head-turning piece of architecture. It kind of looks like a field house, or maybe an overgrown shed.
A thing of beauty, huh? a big brick building. It's not the outside that matters, it's what's inside.
Nick Lawler is the general manager of the Littleton Electric Light and Water Departments. He oversees the drinking water for all the residents and businesses in this town of about 10,000. And today, he's showing off his latest project.
This is ratepayer money, so we didn't put a lot of funding into decorations.
The plant will remove PFAS and other contaminants from Littleton's drinking water. And it's costing about $16 million. That's a lot of money for a small town. The annual budget for the water department is usually around $4 million. Water and Sewer Superintendent Corey Godfrey points out where that money is going.
I guess the first thing you notice is 10 very large filter vessels. They look like big steel tanks, basically.
The tanks that will filter PFAS are so big, they had to cut a hole in the floor to fit them.
And you can see they're much, much larger. They go down into the basement.
Whoa. Why are they so big? I guess they just have to be that big?
So that's the carbon that you need to remove the amount of PFAS we have.
In 2020, Massachusetts set a limit on the amount of PFAS in public drinking water. Since then, towns like Littleton have spent millions trying to remove it. The state limit is one of the strictest in the country, 20 parts per trillion. That's like a drop of water in a swimming pool.
So that gives you a sense of really how toxic these chemicals are.
Wendy Heiger-Bernays is a toxicologist at Boston University. She advised the state on the PFAS regulations. PFAS chemicals have been used in thousands of products since the mid-20th century, from food packaging to firefighting foam. They leach into groundwater from landfills, military bases, factories, and other locations, and they stick around for a very long time. Because they are so pervasive, Heiger-Bernays says, meeting the state's strict drinking water limit is difficult and expensive.
It is a real problem because the cost of doing this, right, is enormous.
Some towns have been able to recoup some costs from polluters if they can trace the contamination to a factory or military base. But in Littleton, it's unclear where the PFAS came from. The water department got state grants and loan forgiveness to help pay for the new plant. But the rest of the bill will be passed on to water customers as a 30% rate hike spread over decades. Again, Nick Lawler with Littleton Light and Water.
It's a lot of money. It's a strain, especially during these economic times. And people are pulling at everything to try to pay their bills. But they understand this community is always, you know, willing to pay for clean water.
So far, 170 water systems in the state have found PFAS over the legal limit. Almost all have brought the contamination down to state levels. But the EPA is expected to announce federal regulations for PFAS in drinking water next month. And the agency has signaled that the new limits will be very low. That means communities across Massachusetts that thought they were in the clear could suddenly have PFAS levels above the legal limit and will have to pay to clean up their water.
So I think that people are very concerned about that piece of it.
Jennifer Peterson is the executive director of the Massachusetts Waterworks Association, an industry group.
You know, substantial investments have been made in Massachusetts to the tunes of, you know, $100 million plus already.
More help is on the way. The federal government is giving the state $38 million to address emerging contaminants like PFAS in drinking water. And last year, then-Attorney General Maura Healey sued manufacturers of firefighting foam containing PFAS. Healey said at the time that she was looking for a settlement, quote, in the millions. But it's doubtful that even millions will be enough to clean up water pollution this widespread. In the end, the cost of clean water will likely be borne by us all.
That's WBUR's Barbara Moran. And WBUR's PFAS reporting continues tomorrow on Morning Edition with a dilemma for homeowners who use private wells. And listen, for tips on how to reduce your exposure to these forever chemicals, you can visit our website at WBUR.org. And now a heads up on what's coming later this week on Radio Boston. First, tomorrow, Governor Maura Healey joins us. She is 1 month into office. Her to-do list is pretty long. We're thinking about everything from housing and the new proposal from the city of Boston on rent control to the need to replace the head of the Massachusetts State Police. She was in Washington last week talking roads and bridges, especially bridges. And then there's that whole thing called the T. So plenty of things to talk about. Question is, what's on your mind? We can take your questions. To ask them, you need to join our texting club. And to get started to do that, you want to text the word Boston to 617-766-0382. That's texting the word Boston to 617-766-0382 to let us know what questions you have for the new governor of Massachusetts, Maura Healey. I want you to close your eyes now and think back. Do you have a favorite food memory? Maybe where you finally mastered a difficult dish, or you tried what's now your favorite food for the first time, or maybe it's a meal with family, or even a first date. For me, it might be the night that my sister Lisa and I burned the oatmeal cake because we were talking so much and we had to sneak into the kitchen and remake it at like midnight that night. Food is powerful, regardless of your age, gender, race, nationality. It has the ability to bring us all together in community. And that is the idea behind a new cookbook called Tasting History. It's a project spearheaded by Lowell High School history teacher Jessica Lander. For the last 5 years, immigrant students in her U.S. 1 history class have compiled their family recipes in that cookbook. This year's edition contains recipes from 21 countries. On Monday, Jessica Lander and two of her students sat down with us in Studio 2 to share their dishes and their histories. Camila Miho Yukawa Bento and Haroon Akhlas, both seniors at Lowell High School, prepared food for all of us to try, and it was delicious. And I started by asking Camila to describe her earliest memory of eating food with her family.
So the first memory is like all my families together having fun, you know. It brings like a lot of memories, like love memories, you know, happy memories with my family that I miss.
Big family?
Yeah, big family.
And you miss them because they're in Brazil?
Yeah, in Brazil and Japan.
And Japan, both.
Yeah, both.
When was the last time you saw your family in Brazil?
3 years ago, yeah.
And how about in Japan?
10 years.
So a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Haroon, do you, when you think back to your youngest childhood, when you think back to when you were really little, do you remember food as part of your family experience when you were really little?
I have a good memory of food, like my family and me were together and cooked a nice, like, this chicken biryani. We cooked them and we enjoyed them a lot. My family and I, we got together and we, like, there was a nice rainy day. My cousin, like, she could cook a good biryani. She was a good cook. And she cooked us that food for us. And that was so delicious. And we enjoyed from that.
And you remember the rain of that day, yeah, and the smells of the food and the, yeah, time with your family.
Yeah, I still remember. That's still in my mind. Yeah.
And that's the dish you brought today, is chicken biryani.
Yeah, chicken biryani. Yeah.
Wonderful. Which I can smell. It smells amazing. And we're going to have it in a little bit. So let's get some context now from Jessica. The students are here for many reasons, but ostensibly because you make a cookbook. Now, we had you recently on Radio Boston with your latest book, which is on really effective ways to help immigrant learners feel really successful in the classroom. And in your book, you talk about this cookbook. But take us to the creation of this cookbook.
Absolutely. So I have the honor and the joy of teaching recent immigrant and refugee students from 30 different countries. And this cookbook, the thinking behind it was the end of our study of immigration at the start of the year. And I'm a history and civics teacher, and so we're studying U.S. history in my classroom, and we're studying the history of immigration from the early 1900s and late 1800s. And when I was first trying to come up with our final project for this unit, I was reading a lot of lesson plans and activity suggestions online that said, imagine your students were leaving their country and had to come to a new country. Or imagine if you were coming to a new country, how would you create a home or community? And of course, my students don't have to imagine because my students are experts. And so I wanted to create a project that would celebrate, that would center our students' history as a part of America's history of immigration, and to center their knowledge, their expertise in the classroom. I also, as I was coming up with this project, had been talking with my own 7th and 8th grade teacher who had a cookbook project for her students. Different. Many of her students have been in the country for multiple generations. Their families have been. But I took this idea talking with my teacher. She shared with me some of her lesson plans. And I thought about how to adapt it for my students to be able to tap into their expertise. And so each of the students would choose a favorite family recipe, and then they'd have to go home and ask their family member for that recipe. No searching on the internet, because we know mom or grandfather or aunt's recipe is so much better than anything we can find on the internet.
And there's all those little things they do, right?
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. And also it centers parents and families at the heart of our classroom as teachers in the classroom, and they are our students' most important teachers. And so they go to their families and they get those recipes and they translate them to English. And then they translate them into language that others who've never cooked their food can follow. So cook until done. And Camila and Harun both know that I question them on these. What does that mean?
How do I know when it's done?
Right. Yeah. Put enough water in. How much is enough? And then, in addition to their recipe, they have to tell a story about the recipe. They have to talk about their memories of this food, of their family. And then also, again, because this is a history class and we're centering their stories of immigration, they have to tell a story about their migration. They get to choose which story they're telling about their migration, but sharing with us so we can learn from them. And we started this project back in 2018, was the first cookbook. This is the fifth edition.
And I'm looking at it here. It's beautiful. It's called Tasting History, 2022 to 2023. I thought it was, I mean, it looks like it's, from reading it, it looks like it's self-published. But this is not something you guys made at Staples at the Copy Center. Like, this is a beautiful, beautiful book.
All of the students, and this is the most fun part for me, is everyone brings in their food. Mm. And we all try each other's food, which is a beautiful way to build connections between each other, to learn from each other. And then I go around taking photographs of everyone's food, which then become the photos in this book. And then we print copies, and each student gets a copy of the book. But then we also share it in the community so that our students are teachers in our community.
All right. So I want to pick up with some food now, because we've talked about a food long enough without me getting to eat any. So now we're going to eat some food. So here's what I want to do. I want to, Harun, I'm going to have you start to put on plates for all of us here your chicken biryani. While you do that, Camila, I will turn to you while Harun is serving. And I'm going to ask you, and I've told Harun and Camila, just serve it up. Don't even be quiet about it, right? We're just going to go ahead and have a meal together here. What was the migration story you decided to tell for your recipe, which we'll try in a little bit, but I don't want you caught serving and talking all at the same time. So tell me your migration story.
So it was like, I was in Brazil with my family, and then my dad came, and then he said, oh, let's move to the U.S. so your mom can be a doctor there. And I said, oh, really? And then it was like, yeah, let's go. And then we took the visa, and then we came here. It was like very, very hard, like, because we don't have, you know, we don't have, like, we don't know people here.
You didn't have family.
No, like, we have to, we didn't speak English too. Like, how we're gonna, like, have work, how we're gonna grow, you know? Mm-hmm. So it was, like, literally very hard, but now it's good, you know?
So you're 19 now.
Yeah, I'm 19.
And you moved when you were 15,
yeah,
if I
15,
remember?
Yeah.
So it's been 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be hard at any time, but a 15-year-old.
Mm-hmm. I was like, I don't have friends.
Yeah. I mean, your whole world is your friendship and your bonds as an adolescent.
Mm-hmm.
And then you come to the U.S., you don't speak the
English,
language,
no.
And you're in a community that is incredibly diverse with people from all over the world.
Yeah.
When did you, well, let me backtrack. Let me not assume you felt ever like you belonged. Do you feel belonging now?
Yeah.
And when and how did that happen?
When I learned the language and when I saw that I am not the only immigrants here, you know, because here in the U.S. we have a lot of immigrants, and I didn't know. I was like, oh, like there, it's just Americans, you know?
Yeah.
And then we have like so many Brazilians here, and I was like, ah, I'm at home. You know?
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
So shall we try Harun's food?
Yeah.
Okay, so Jessica and Camila, you guys taste. I'm going to taste too. Harun, tell us what's in this dish.
Oh, this is rice and chicken and some spices.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Mm-hmm. Maybe some oil.
Oil, yeah. Oil mm-hmm. and...
What's the key spice? I'm looking at the recipe. So this recipe is...
key spice
is on page 112 and 113 of the book, right? So we've got, let's see, what are some... Oh, cumin.
Oh, yeah.
Salt, pepper, biryani masala.
Yeah, biryani masala.
Tomatoes, vegetable oil, chicken. Okay, so when Jessica asked you, how will you know when it's done? What did you write in your recipe for how people would know when the dish was done?
When the rice and chicken is cooked, that's done. Like,
it's that easy.
Yeah, that's easy.
Is but this a very easy dish?
Yeah, that's easy. In the cooking, it takes like 1 hour or one or more than that to cook.
It's so good.
Yeah.
So is this your grandmother's recipe or your mother's recipe?
No, it's actually like a Afghanistan recipe. Like everyone cooked this and everyone like they enjoyed them. Yeah. But that's
whole
like...
Whole community,
yeah. The whole community.
When I taste this dish, mm-hmm. right, I'm not from Afghanistan, but I have Italian heritage. And it reminds me of my Nonna saffron risotto. That's what it reminds me
of.
In your cooking heritage, what in this dish makes you think of cooking in your own world?
This?
Mm-hmm. What dish does Haroun's remind
it's
you of?
Stroganoff.
Stroganoff.
Yeah. It reminds me.
There you go.
You know stroganoff?
Yes, absolutely I do.
Oh, I didn't know.
Yeah. And it reminds you of that.
Yeah.
How about you, Jessica, when you taste it?
I
know I'm going to eat another bite. It's so good.
I know. It's so good. So there was a really wonderful Indian restaurant around the corner from me growing up. Mm-hmm. And it reminds me of particularly the rice that I had growing up every week there.
And Haroun, you actually say, I'm looking at the recipe page from the book, and it says, originally, biryani is an Indian dish, but as Afghanistan is near India, this dish became so common in Afghanistan, too. We used to cook this dish when guests were in our house. We still cook it sometimes because it tastes delicious.
Yeah.
Is it your favorite?
Yeah.
It is?
Yeah.
What do you love so much about it?
So I love the rice. Actually, I love every kind of rice. And when it cooks like a chicken biryani, that's so delicious, yeah.
Yeah. And did you make this or did a family member make this?
No, my mom did this and I helped her like a little bit. So that's like I was not that much like free or like I was and I had a heavy schedule of work. That's I couldn't help that much with my mom.
You work and you're a senior in high school.
Yeah.
Yeah. How many hours a week do you work?
Like 20 hours.
So that's a lot because you're a full-time high school student as well.
Yeah.
All right, so here's what we're going to do. Camila, I'm going to ask you to start plating your dish for us now. And while you serve your dish, I'm going to ask you your migrant story. What do you want to share, Haroun, from your migrant story?
In 2022, when the Taliban took Afghanistan, and we moved to UAE. Like, we stayed there for 2.5 months in a humanitarian camp. And so from there, we came to the Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
So first, you
were in the United Arab Emirates for a few months.
Yeah, United Arab Emirates,
and then you went to Virginia.
Virginia, like, we stayed there in a Marine camp that called Fort Pickett.
Mm-hmm.
That was a military camp.
Fort
Pickett. So we stayed there for 1.5 months, and then we moved here to Lahore.
Did you feel safe and taken care
of? When I leave Afghanistan, like I came to UAE, I felt safe. It was so like a bad situation in Afghanistan. When the Taliban took control over Afghanistan, everyone trying to get to the airplane and like leave Afghanistan. So that was hard time.
Does home here feel like home now?
Yeah.
What feels most like home?
My family is with me, and my dad, my family, my other Afghans live here with me. Like, I feel like I live in my own country.
Do you still have family in Afghanistan?
Yeah, I have 3 sisters there.
Do you get to talk to them?
I talk to them sometime.
And do you feel safe for them? Do you think they're
safe? Yeah, they're safe. Like, yeah.
Good. Good. So in a minute, we're going to try Camila's dish. But quickly before we do, I want to bring Jessica back into the conversation for a second. And I want to understand, sometimes when I'm talking to a guest here on the show, Jessica, it's like echoes and voices of other guests and their stories are banging around in the room. When we hear Camila's story and Haroun's story, What echoes around for you with all the young people that you've taught and worked with and made cookbooks with over the years? I think you've been in Lowell since 2015, right?
I have, yeah.
Yeah. I'm stealing another bite of Haroon's food.
Oh, please do.
While I can, and then we'll move to Camila's. Go ahead.
I think I'm reminded, particularly, and always when listening to my students and listening right now again to Camila and Haroon share parts of their migration stories, and just reminded of the strengths of my students and just all the incredible, just amazing assets they bring to the classroom, the perspectives they bring that enrich our classroom. The strength they have in leaving home countries, leaving family in home countries, and coming here and building a new home, that's really hard to do. And to see them do that with such courage and with such strength and sometimes with joy, our classrooms can be a really fun place. But just, I think, that reminder of the amazing strengths my students have. And that's, I think, part of the reason that we created this cookbook was a way to ensure that our community could learn from our students. They have so much to offer each other and to teach each other about their journeys and about the perspectives of having lived in many different countries. And they have so much to teach our community, but definitely the strengths of my students. They are amazing and so, so inspiring to me.
Are you amazing, Camila?
Yeah.
Haroon?
Yeah.
What makes you amazing, Camila?
What makes me amazing? Wait, what do you mean?
No.
Yeah. What do you mean, like amazing?
Yeah.
Oh, what makes me amazing? It's like my history, you know?
Yeah.
My history makes me amazing, make me proud of myself. Yeah.
And Haroon, what makes you amazing?
Amazing, like...
Special.
Special. Lowell High School and being with Miss Lander.
Aww.
Yeah. Being a student with Miss Lander.
Makes you feel special?
Yeah.
That's great. All right. So shall we try the other dish? So here's what we'll do. Haroon and Jessica and I, this one we eat with our fingers, yes?
Mm-hmm.
We're going to try this. This is onigiri with salmon. Yeah. And this is from your home and your family. So mm-hmm. while we taste it, you tell us what this dish is.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
So this dish is onigiri. It's not from Brazil, but it is from Japan.
Mm.
And this recipe is from my grandfather. He was making it. He's Japanese. And... This recipe is like literally my story. Miss Lander was helping me to try to find some recipes. I was like, Miss Lander, which one I can make from Brazil or from Japan? Which one? And then she was like, send me pictures of some recipes. And then we were talking, right, about the onigiri. And then she say, oh, you can make about it. And then I was like, oh, yeah, I have so many memories about onigiris. When I was like coming from school, when I got home, there was like onigiri on the table. It was.
Did
like,
your grandfather live in the home with you?
Yeah, no, in Brazil.
In Brazil, right.
Yeah.
But he did there.
Mm-hmm.
And so you'd come home and your grandfather's there and he's made this onigiri.
Mm-hmm.
And what do you love most about it?
The
food.
The food, the memories.
Yeah. All right, the so memories. Have we all tasted it? Haroon, have you had it before?
No.
This is your first time?
Yeah, my first time, but it's delicious. Yeah, it's yummy.
What does it make you think of from Afghan cooking?
Oh, it's like a kind of another kind of rice. We mm-hmm. cook them with the yogurt.
And we know you like rice.
Yeah, I know rice. I know I like rice, and it's a kind of like rice with yogurt.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yogurt and oil.
Yes.
And so like it's another kind of famous food or like everyone
popular food.
Yeah. That's so delicious. Like when I eat just this food, I remember that food. Like that's so delicious. Yeah,
it is really amazing.
Yeah,
Camila, what do you think when you hear Haroon, who's from Afghanistan, right, say this reminds me of a dish from home, and you were picking a dish trying to straddle two completely other homes, right? Two mm-hmm. other countries, Brazil and Japan.
Mm-hmm.
There's just the world can be so small.
Yeah.
Does it make you...
The world can connect. Like, they can connect, you know? Like, it's different countries, but, like, the same remember the same taste, yes. You know, we can like remind of something.
It keeps us connected. And Jessica, food does connect us.
It does. I think it's just a beautiful way of creating space to make connections and seeing the day where we bring like all of our desks are covered in food and watching students just like Haroon and Camila are tasting each other's food for the first time, watching students from all over the globe taste each other's food and find those connections. I've never had this, but it reminds me of food from home. It's so beautiful to watch.
And who made this, Camila? Did you?
Yeah, me. Last night.
Very good.
Well, I'll have to say, Camila, your story about getting this recipe, because Camila got this recipe while she was in class one day. And I was wondering, Camila, if you could share.
Tell us the story.
I had to call to my grandfather. Yeah, at school. I was at school.
You're at school and you're calling your grandfather in Brazil.
Yeah, in Brazil. And we don't have like so much internet at school. It's so bad. But I called him and then I like he now is so proud of myself because I'm here in Boston telling about onigiris, you know. He's very proud of myself, and I am too.
You know, this show streams on the internet. Mm-hmm. He can listen to it anytime.
Yeah.
So what would you like to say to your grandfather?
In Portuguese or English?
However you want to do it.
So, Dicham, I miss you a lot, and one day I will be there with you. I will cry.
It's okay. When we love our families, it makes us feel strongly. And Haroon, is there anybody you'd like to say something to? Maybe your sisters in Afghanistan?
Yeah. I will say them to Polo Hanus Ram Lira Minalaram Aucha po Belhosus Polemorsara. Just as I said that I love my sisters, I love my mom. And I'm so sad about them. Like I miss them so much. Except my mom is here, but I miss my sisters. Like they're in Afghanistan. Yeah, I miss them a lot.
Jessica, I don't want to cut you out of the shout outs. Is there anyone you want to say something to?
I want to thank my students. It is really powerful, even just listening to them here talk about their foods, talk about their families. It can take a lot of bravery and courage to share stories with each other. And so I'm just so grateful to be able to learn with them and from them every day.
That was Jessica Lander, a history and civics teacher at Lowell High School. Also with us, Camila Miho Yukawa Bento and Haroon Akhlas, both seniors at Lowell High School. If you're interested in learning more about or buying this year's edition of Tasting History or past editions, you can visit the Lowell High School student store in person or online. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.